Once again, good morning and welcome Deputy Minister Glenda and the official from the Department of ERCO, as well as members of Parliament and the officials working in both departments. Both department and Parliament, and of course our visitor. The agenda is before us. I will come back to apologies. I just want to add a very important agenda item here as number five, which will be joint oversight visit to KZN. By the Peace and Stability Club. Okay, let's go back to the apologies, Secretary. Luba, are there any apologies that need to be noted by anything?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. I have two apologies. One from Honorable Kabir, who attended the People's Forum, and another one from Honorable Minister. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ormis and Honorable Darley. One of them has a permanent apology. I don't know which one. It's just one. Can I hear you on the apologies? I think there's no problem. Can I hear you on the agenda? Is there anyone who wants to add something into our agenda? I've already added one. With your permission, can it be adopted? Can everyone to speak first? Thank you very much, Honorable Khadebe and Honorable Raputi. Well, our first item today will be the legal opinion on the sub judice rule, which will be presented by the Parliamentary Legal Services, represented by Ms. Nathi Mjengane. I don't think we need any long background to this, but many of you would remember that as a committee, we decided that we should seek a legal opinion from Parliament around the issue of President Al-Bashir, who had visited the AU summit in South Africa and left. There was a court decision that he should have been arrested. So when we had a debate here, the department was unable to sit to this matter because of the subsidiary rule, and there was committee members then said we must get our own legal opinion on this matter. I now want to defer to Mr. Nati Jengmane to present the legal opinion. Is it written? Where is it written? Where are the copies? Yeah, but you must distribute them. Want to read verbatim? You know the lawyer? So put a verbatim. Why do you listen to me when I say you know the lawyer? Because you are one. No, she's one.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honorable this man can listen to work, so I'll just say.
Yes, thank you very much.
Chair, I'm just going to briefly go through the little opinion numbers that you provided, the copy of the opinion. I will try not to spend too much time going through and reading everything in the opinion. I'll just stick to speaking to salient points in the opinion and possibly take questions after I have presented from members. In this legal opinion, Chair, we received this request sometime in August, subsequent to the departure of President Rashid when he visited South Africa. The circumstances around this are well known to members, and we don't request them in opinion. Essentially, in the request for opinion, we were still answering two important questions. The one question was whether the statutory rule is applicable to the committee, the Portfolio Committee on Internal Relations, and if it does apply, whether it prevents the committee from briefing, from getting briefing from the department, or on the same matter. The background, as I've noted, the background to the matter of our President Bashir, as well as the matter that came before the North Carolina High Court on the circumstances around his departure, and the resultant judgment that came from that case is common cause, I would assume. And I don't repeat it in this presentation. But I do mention, importantly, for this discussion, that the court issued an order for the arrest of President Bashir and found that the government had failed. Or government failure to arrest him was inconsistent with the Constitution. That was essentially the findings of the North Carolina Court. The Department, therefore, noted an appeal against this decision, and this decision was therefore suspended in terms of the Supreme Court Act as well as the Income Rules of the High Court. That was for the introduction and the ground. Now, to answer the question, whether the statutory rule is applicable to the committee. We state in the opinion that committees are an extension of the House of the Assembly, and that the National Assembly rules are applicable to committees. Rule 67 of the National Assembly rules states that no member shall refer to any matter on which a judicial decision is pending. Is therefore applicable in this instance in the committee. However, Chair, we must hasten to point out that the legal standards for testing whether a matter is adjudicated and therefore should be entertained or not entertained by a different forum was decided in a very important decision by the Supreme Court of Appeal. That decision was the media television versus the director of prosecuting judgment. Without going much into the fact of that case, the court decided that a prohibition on sharing of information to protect the proper administration of justice must only be allowed if prejudice, number one, to the administration of justice is demonstrable and substantial, and that there is a real risk that prejudice might result from sharing of information. The court also pointed out, very importantly, that mere speculation or conjecture would not be sufficient basis foreign the subject of the role to protect the Senate or to bar Senate of information. Informed by the judgment that has just highlighted the chair as well as the rule in the National Assembly rule, we then went on to look at the appeal papers that are before the Supreme Court of Appeal and sort of took the information that we got from the appeal papers to the facts, the little facts that we had. And on perusing both, we are of the view, Chair, that if the committee or in the event that the committee invited the director to come and give a presentation around the circumstances of the departure of our president Bashir, and that should a discussion ensue, there might be a potential during the deliberation to adversely affect that which is yet to be decided by the court in their case. And whether the subjudicator prevents the committee from requesting a briefing from the ERCOT. Our final chair in this instance was that it does not in itself prevent the committee. The subjudicator rule does not in itself prevent the committee from inviting the ERCOT to come and do a presentation around the issue and discussion. However, there is a further inquiry that the committee might have to go through to make a determination, which is the one that updated in the media television decision. While the committee has an inherent right to invite the department to its oversight function, oversight constitutional obligation, to come and give a presentation on this matter, in the opinion we advise that the committee may wish to postpone the briefing until all of the legal disputes that are in the appeal now and still before judicial consideration have been finalized. And we are of the view that that would assist the committee to effectively carry out its mandate, rather than delving into the issue now once it's still going to be discussed and finalized, which might potentially upset the sub-judicial people that have highlighted. That's essentially how we've described it, Chair, that the law in itself does not prevent the committee from inviting the to come and give a presentation. The rules in Rule 67, because of the decision that was taken by the National Assembly to defer to the judicial and therefore strengthen the separation of power on all of those matters that are still under judicial consideration. Rule 67 is therefore enacted in light of that consideration and the decision of the National Assembly to err on the side of caution on matters that are currently before judicial consideration. And at the same time that those matters have been finalized and the determination to inform the work of Parliament, this rule then was therefore enacted. However, I just want to highlight the fact that there is a standard that was set in the mid-television decision. And where the committee has to make a decision about whether to call or not call the judge, they must look into the rule in Rule 67, they must look into the mid-television standard which I've already explained, and the committee must then make a determination from there. The one last point that I would like to make is that in the event that the committee decided to invite the judge to make a determination, the chairperson will be as a chairperson presiding over the matter with the responsibility to ensure that this proper administration of justice is not finished. By delving into those matters that are still yet to be considered by the court and therefore potentially prejudicing the right of Odergo to a fair trial, which is the right that is enshrined in the Constitution, and the right that is that him expression to the subjudicator of the Constitution. Thank you very much,
sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Mane. It is really a very strange thinking, that you can invite a suspect. You can, but the person may not be anything.
Yeah.
The rule does not prevent you from inviting that person. Okay, I want to hand over to members to express themselves. Honorable Kalyan, is it correct? Is it up or is it? Oh, yeah, okay. Kalyan, and then followed by the gentleman. Okay. Okay. And Mukab. And Hassan.
Thank you.
I would further clarity on the status of the case now, since there is a ruling that or judgment on it has been reserved. What does that mean and what implications does that have? And then with regard to Rule 67, that rule was disregarded in the House 2 weeks ago. And even Honorable Naledi Pandor stood up and said, well, you know, if the rule is irrelevant, it must be deleted from the book. And I'm in the process with the, on the task team that is now dealing with the rules. Although we are moving like a village cow, as the deputy speaker has said. But that is in progress, and next week we're going to be finalizing those rules. And I submit that Rule 67 is actually not relevant. And what would the legal persons have to say about that?
Thanks. And just if you look on page 3 at the bottom, it does say that you're ordinarily prohibited from being prohibited from being adjudicated elsewhere. The balance on the fact that if something is going to be adjudicated, there's going to be an adjudication of it, then it's prevented from being brought up as under the that's prevented from being brought up in that forum, where I believe it could be a secondary adjudication process. On page 5, the real meat of what needs to be said here, because as you've correctly identified, Chair, there seems to be a very safe curtailing around the sub-30K rule. You know, we're saying it can be brought up, but it can't really be brought up. But here it says a real risk of prejudice as opposed to a remote possibility of interference. And what you find is the balance has to be really on the fact of we need to prove that there would be a risk of prejudice rather than prove that there would be a remote possibility of interference. So if there's a remote possibility of interference, you're not protected by sub judice. Where you're only protected by sub judice, there's a real risk of prejudice. And the real risk of prejudice, as the legal advisor has said, is something that can materially affect the case. So something that's mentioned as to what the merit of that case that was being argued. So again, and we've had the precedent in Parliament where it was raised again, and the minister, I think it was the minister or the deputy minister, tried to get up and use the sub judice rule again, and the speaker shut that down, an argument that it was already on paper, and the argument had to carry on. So the balance really has to be that we must prove that what is being reported is going to have a real risk of prejudice, as opposed to the fact that it's going to just have the remote possibility of interference. But the other part of it, which I don't see here, is that would it hinder the work of the separated powers? So let's say we're the administration, and we were seeking a briefing. Would our work be hampered by such a report not being reported to us? Because there's a feeling of subjudice, and that's the question we still then have to ask.
Thank you very much, Honourable Benjamin. Honourable Halaba.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me appreciate the fact that you took the committee with your confidence by definitely asking for a written response from the Parliamentary Legal Services. Thank you for doing that fiduciary duty. Let me also thank Nati for the response in terms of the legal opinion. And I think I will take it from the premise that says that there's nothing stopping us, and there's nothing stopping the department giving us a brief. And I think that is what Nati is saying to us. And I think I would not dwell into the irrelevant Rule 67, which the Rules Committee is going to nullify. So, in essence, what it means is that, Deputy Minister, you can start preparing your presentation for the committee. There's nothing stopping you doing that session. Because one thing that I would want to find is the correspondence in the document that has been brought before the court. If we can ascertain that, because if I don't think that DICO is a respondent, I might be wrong, but can we find out if DICO is a respondent in one or in those Supreme Court of Appeal documents. and I think the matter is quite clear. We then proceed, and the president was said 2 weeks ago when the speaker allowed a debate on the matter, and we had a debate of public importance as well on the matter. So, in my opinion, the subject rule doesn't apply, and I think the legal department has been very careful to tread carefully on this, while we expect it from lawyers. You know, so they are treading carefully. They are saying, yes, the sub judice rule is there, 67, this committee must subscribe because of it's an extension of the National Assembly. They are saying, yeah, okay, you got to adhere to that rule. But however, there was this case of precedent that was said, which should nullify the sub judice rule. So they have left it to us. There's nothing wrong with the department giving us a briefing. So I would suggest that we proceed with the briefing. And perhaps maybe when we come back, we get that briefing from the department. Thank you very much, Chief.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khlapa. Honorable Mason.
I really have to change
that.
So anyway, I have to change it.
According to your color.
I'm divorced. Okay, so now my contribution to the matter. I want to get a role of the legal department in the next year. Nothing is only to see. Because, as other colleagues have mentioned, it's very, very important.
Thank you, my contribution. As I'm saying this, I just want to get a role of a legal department in a nutshell. As other colleagues were saying, this Rule 67 has become irrelevant, and I think it's high time for the legal department to clarify this. Not here, not on the specific case of President Al-Bashir. Because as they are putting this, the colleague from the DA is quoting that, if you remember very well, Chair, in the House, before we wrote a letter to the speaker to say we can't allow to table the ad hoc support in the National Assembly because the AFF has taken this matter to court. Then the speaker replied to us to say no, we can. And we even stood up in the House to court, this is Rule 67. And on the other hand, the stood up and said no, we can't proceed. So I just want to get the role. I remember when I was serving as a councillor, the deputy minister, you might know, in the Czech municipality. When we have our council meeting, we always have a legal person there. When all political parties want to interpret a certain rule, a legal person will give legal opinion right there. I think it's high time for this parliament also to review in that way. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chope. Honorable Homlan, what's your name?
Yes, microphone. We need to ask ourselves two questions. The first one is, I want the legal people to listen. We need to ask ourselves two questions. The first one is, do we have to hear this thing before the judgment, which is now pending, is given? What is this thing that is pricking us that so urgently that we are going to hear this thing, given political and legal? That's the first question. The second question is, at the moment, are we allowed to refer? Are we saying that Rule 67 is not ruling that is a final? The answer is it is. What the people said in the assembly is neither here nor there. If you say we flouted it in. They did it in the last. Why can't we did it too? That's something different. It is finding us. We can't refer it. until it is changed. Before it is changed, it is then binding. So we can't say, he has stolen, let us steal too. No. So, secondly, the decision of the court, as I say, that unless there is something so urgent, so that would really, the department is marked, we have got to oversee the department. But what is it that we want to oversee at the moment? And so on. So I believe that we need to just allow the court to come, even if the department is not party to that court case. I think they have got an interest. Even if it's not party to it, it's immaterial. They cannot be seen to be coming up with something that the court still has to decide. Thank you.
Honorable Khatele, you are holding the mic.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to appreciate the presentation made by the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, Mr. Nzengane. Honorable Chairperson, I think that it would be wrong for this committee to start changing the rules of the House without the House having changed them. That there is a process of reviewing the rules does not mean that it has been finalized. That's why the only on the review process, I'm also part of that, of the committee. So what is concerned, we have not yet adopted the new rules. So since we have not yet adopted the new rules, it means that Rule 7 is still applicable. And then when coming to this issue here, I think the legal opinion is very clear, is that there's a risk that when the department is going to present to the portfolio committee, it can face with its case at the Supreme Court of Appeal. So what is critical here is that do we want the justice to miscarry now? I don't think that we can allow that situation. So what is critical here is that the appeal, that's why even all the debates in the House there, you find that all the relevant ministers who participated in the debate before, they were those who are having this appeal, not the appeal. They were not part of the discussion. So that whoever was going to add anything was not going to affect this ministry. So I think that what happened in the House of Commons also put it into perspective. Even the issue of the ad hoc committee report, it was very clear then during that time that case which was launched by the EFF was not even on the roll yet. It was not even, that's why whatever panel stood up with the photos, even the speech was very clear on that point, that yes, but even as parliament themselves, they didn't even have paper that they have been challenged about this thing. So those circumstances are different. But what the critical say here is that we, as the portfolio committee, we have accepted a legal opinion. And the legal opinion is in front of us. When you look at the very last recommendation of that legal opinion, which was requested by us, so it means that these are our lawyers. It says, in order to mitigate the risk identified above, the committee may consider to put forth in the briefing until such time that the courts have determined the legal dispute. What is critical here is that we can engage as a committee. Once the court arrives at a different decision, we are going to be bound to change the decision of the committee again. So why involve ourselves in an extra weekend if you can? Because here in South Africa, once the court has taken a decision, it is binding. It is binding. So we go and investigate this thing, we put this thing here, we arrive at a certain decision, the court arrives at a different decision. We have to come back again to, don't have to comply with the court decision. We have to come back again to the, why should we do that? So I think that this legal opinion report, let's respect it. Let us not call the DERCO. I think that very soon, this thing will be in court, and they will come and no, that case will not disappear. The facts are not going to, that means that if each day passes, the facts are changing. of what happened around President al-Bashir. The threat will still be the same. So even if it's next year, if they and then come back and they will engage with that. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much, Honorable
Mr. Ngenyane, do you want to respond to one or two things? I'm interested in what Arun Kalyan was saying, that judgment has been reserved. What happened when judgment has been reserved on a matter, and you have this rule, sub judice, and judgment has not been given? What happened? What is it? Yeah,
I'm
very interested just in that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Chair, I was so anxious to present the opinion. I got to introduce my parliamentary senior legal advisor to my rights, Mr. Banara. And with him is also Mr. Matisse, who is also a colleague at our office. Mr.
Banara.
Banara. Yes, he's a parliamentary legal advisor. Oh,
okay.
Yes. And let's see, Mr. Matisse, who just joined us as an intern at the department. Mr. Manoel is my senior officer. I will defer him as a practice in fact for him to answer, and I will also answer to some of the questions after him. Thank you, Chair.
thank you, Chair. Good morning to the honourable members, as well as the deputy minister. I am not going to respond to the questions in the order in which they were presented. On the status of the judgment that is appealed against, the effect of noting an appeal against a judgment is that the status and the force of that judgment appealed against becomes suspended. In other words, it cannot be implemented immediately. In this particular case, I think there's a specific question around reserving judgment. What is the effect of a judgment that has been reserved? The status of the judgment that has been reserved is that there is no judgment because judgment has not been pronounced and that the matter is still pending. The relevance of Rule 67, what is our view? Our view is that my colleague Mr. Mjemane has given the background to the genesis of the rule. It is found that both in common law, remembered position in common, I think the opinion does speak to that position, that it is actually an offense to delve into matters that are before court, because that is viewed as contempt of court proceedings. And that position has changed. The rule also has basis on the separation of powers principle, which the Assembly took a conscious decision to defer courts on matters that are pending. And the Rule 67 is in our rule books. It is still, therefore, valid and applicable unless it has been removed from the rule book. So that is the status of Rule 67. However, I need to point out that there seems to be confusion around the application of Rule 67. The Rule 67, it is imperative to note that is not a one-size-fits-all approach. It has to be applicable, and its application has to be tested in respect of the circumstances of each case. So that it has been allowed to stop debate in one instance does not necessarily mean that it will stop debate in all instances. Question, I think, around whether the committee, whether it's necessary for the committee to hear the matter prior to the judgment. And there's a second question asking about the agency on hearing this matter. I think the opinion, and one member, honorable member, commented and agree with that comment, that we left that decision. It is not for us to decide. We do not have the competency to make decisions on behalf of the committee. but it is the competence of committee to make a decision. All we did is to identify the rule. We pointed out to the risks inherent in the process, and we cautioned the committee that it might, in its own wisdom, consider. We didn't say it must decide, it said it must concede, it might consider to postpone this until the matter has been dealt with by the court. The reason for that is one, because of the risk that we've identified. Secondly, it is a cautionary approach because the common law, this might well be a commission of an offense. But we do not think in that vein that the commission of the offense might necessarily be in this instance because of the privileges that members enjoy in proceedings of both committees and in the House. The role of the legal advisors of Parliament is the role of any lawyer in any institution, which is to look at the legal challenge that has been identified and provide legal views around that particular matter. It is imperative to note that we are not judges, we do not proffer to be judges, and we do not our judgments. All we do is we make our own assessments and advise accordingly. That is my contribution, Chair. I think that which I have not responded to, my colleague will have you deal with. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My senior legal advisor has answered most of the questions. I just wish to comment on the question or comment by Honorable Berman about the real risk versus the remote risk. Again, in line with what Mr. Vanera has said, that is left up to the committee through its deliberations to decide whether the risk was either be real or remote. We have not decided that issue in legal opinion. And on whether DERCO is a respondent in the appeal papers, the appeal papers that we received from the executive, which have been filed with the court, DERCO is the fifth respondent. The Minister for International Relations is the fifth respondent in those, and therefore DERCO is definitely part of this litigation that is yet to be decided by the Supreme Court of Appeal. And the one last comment I wanted to make that where a judgment has been suspended by noting of the appeal, it does not leave one without recourse. In terms of the Superior Court Act in Section 19, one can apply to the court for the judgment to be implemented whilst the state of the appeal. Thank you very much. On Rule 67, Mr. Vanera has answered, and on the issue of judgment being reserved, Mr. Vanera has answered. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Kalyan. We want to come back.
I just want to make a comment. The ICC has requested South Africa to give an explanation by the 5th of October on its actions. So I would be interested to know now if this matter is before the court, if it is pending, would we be in a position to meet the 5th of October deadline? What are our obligations in that respect?
Well, I don't know who's going to answer that because we don't have it in writing. Honorable Deputy Minister, will you assist on the comment made by Honorable Kalyan?
That's not a comment, it's a question.
Yeah.
And it is so, you can look it up on the ICC website. And DECO has received a request from the International Criminal Court asking for an explanation. It is the intention of the department to meet that obligation by the 5th, if not before.
Thank you very much.
Chair, we discussed this matter yesterday in Pretoria, and that was the very question I asked. And the Office of Chief State Law Advisor was present, made it clear to us that the two processes are separate, and therefore we cannot say to the ICC, you must suspend your process, nor can the Federal South African courts suspend your process. So the two processes proceed.
Okay. Therefore, the advice that we have received is that we should not proceed with this matter until judgment has been given. And once judgment has been given to the five departments, we will then request Darko to come and give an explanation about this matter. And I think we can then close the matter at that. In terms of this development. Thank you very much, Mr. Chinglane and Mr. Vanara and Masiza. Also, you can stay on if you want to, but you can also be released.
Thank you,
sir. The next item is very legal. Privileges and Immunities Act. Thank you very much. The next issue here is a presentation by the department on the privileges and immunities extended to diplomats in South Africa and the challenges of implementation in relation to the Vienna Convention on Privileges and Immunities in Diplomatic Relations of 1961 and the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations of 1963 and the UN Convention on Privileges and Immunities of 1946 and of course South Africa's Immunities and Privileges Act of 2001. I am now going to hand over to our Deputy Minister. And of course the Deputy Minister will be assisted by the official from the department. Deputy Minister.
Chairperson, thank you. I welcome this opportunity. The presentation you're going to receive is, I believe, for members of your portfolio committee, a very important one. It sets out in very clear legal terms the activity of diplomats and what they can and can't do, as well as the countries in the international sphere. And so effectively, the act which is going to be explained to you, to my mind, would serve as a Bible without offending people of other religions. For members of the Portfolio Committee. I have with me today we have in the wheelchair next to the lady is Advocate Rian Diaga. Advocate Diaga is a member of the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor in Durko. Durko is one of two departments that has an auxiliary office in the department. Next to Advocate Diaga is Ms. Lynn De Jong. Ms. De Jong is the Director, Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges. And the two of them will make the presentation to you. Behind me is my friend and comrade, Dr. Eddie Maloka. He is professor. Well, I'm correct, Mr. Chair. It's Professor. Sorry, I promise. Who is here to assist if necessary. And so, Chairperson, without further ado, let me hand over to two officials so that they can make the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honourable members, we're going to be talking about diplomatic immunities and privileges, as the Chair indicated. Now, it's quite legal. It's a legal framework. Now, the Vienna Conventions on Diplomatic Relations of 1961 and the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations of 1963 are incorporated in the South African Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act, number 37 of 2001, and it was also amended with number 35 of 2008, as Schedule 1 and 2. This basically makes it domestic law, so it makes it South African law. The Act is commonly referred to as the DIPA. Now, the Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the UN of 1946 applies to the UN and its officials only. Now, South Africa provides equal treatment to all states in terms of Article 47.1 of the Vienna Convention. Now, we often hear of the term reciprocity. So we have actually applied reciprocity. It is equal treatment to all foreign missions. So in other words, they get exactly the same immunities and privileges in South Africa. To give an example, one of the privileges would be a duty-free vehicle. So if you're a single person, it's one vehicle. If you're married, it would be two. Other countries would say you can have 5 or 10 vehicles. It's more, the wealthier countries that will actually then apply the principle of reciprocity. But as I say, we apply equal treatment. There are 350 foreign missions in South Africa. Now, these consist of diplomatic missions, consular missions, honorary consular missions, international organizations, and we've got one liaison office, which is Taiwan. Now, we also have the second largest diplomatic corps in South Africa after Washington. It totals more than 10,000 diplomats and their families. So we actually regularize a very large group of people. So we do have quite a responsibility as Jericho in that regard. Now, coming out of the actual act, is a post-document that we have on the management of diplomatic immunities and privileges, which then determines how do we actually implement this act in South Africa. In this regard, state protocol, and that's where the mandate lies in JOPO, we confer and manage the immunities and privileges in South Africa to diplomats, and we are the authority on. For example, when a diplomat arrives, they will get a diplomatic identity card. We then register them at JOPO. We issue them with temporary residence visas. So it's not the Department of Home Affairs that does a physical issuing. We actually get the labels from Home Affairs. We do that ourselves at Durko. Responsible for diplomatic property. Diplomatic motor vehicles. That's what diplomatic numbers. You would have seen those in Cape Town. They're the consular ones. We deal with South African diplomatic passports. Foreign and South African diplomatic and consular appointments. For example, a foreign ambassador gets appointed here, there's a process to be followed. When we send our ambassadors abroad, there's also a process to be followed. We also then do visas for South African diplomatic and official passport holders. So in a nutshell, that is the responsibility of state protocol within JERCA. We also have a liaison function with SAPS on diplomatic security, with the public on minor immunity disputes. We engage with the chief state law advisor frequently, in terms of the act. It can be international law and major disputes, and then also, for example, the CCMA on labor disputes involving locally recruited staff members. Now, we'll find a lot of foreign missions will employ South Africans. They won't have contracts. They'll make them work 7 days a week. They won't pay them other time. But obviously, we need to deal with all of those issues, and we have disputes that we have to deal with. Now, immunity. It confers a procedural protection from the enforcement processes in the receiving state. Now, South Africa is the receiving state. The other country will be the sending state. And our privilege, our gate example, the case of a duty-free vehicle, that would then be a privilege that a diplomat gets. Now, diplomatic immunity, what does it actually mean? We say, for example, immunity from jurisdiction and criminal patterns. Now, the example I'd like to use here is, let's say an ambassador's son has raped somebody. Now, in terms of our criminal act, that person can be arrested, charged with rape. But in this case, because the person has got full diplomatic immunity, they cannot be arrested. They cannot be touched. But do not despair. We are going to explain how we're going to address some of those issues. There's also immunity from jurisdiction in civil and administrative cases, except matters involving, for example, private immovable property, succession in a state executor or heir in a private capacity, or any professional or commercial activity outside of diplomatic functions. Now, when a diplomat comes to South Africa, the Vienna Conventions are quite clear. There are certain things that you do which is termed diplomatic function. So you cannot be running a business at the same time. You have to choose. Are you here a diplomat or a businessman? You can't do both. Diplomatic inviolability. What does it mean? Here, inviolability is a term used to express the rule that no agent of the receiving state or citizens may interfere with anyone entitled to immunities and privileges. Further on, what does it imply? We've already indicated diplomatic services or properties. Example I have to use here, let us just say that a rhino has been poached, the rhino horn has been chopped off, and they take it off to the embassy, they put it in a diplomatic pouch, or they send it. Now, none of that can be touched. The piece cannot enter the embassy, cannot enter the residence of the diplomat, may not actually even stop a vehicle and search a diplomatic vehicle because of its inviolability. The diplomatic bag or pouch, the person of a diplomat, the personal effects of a diplomat. And if there's any transgression in this regard, the DIPA makes it quite clear in terms of Section 15. If, for example, law enforcement officials try to then enter a premises, we can then, as JOCO, open up a case against that law enforcement person, or whether it's an attorney or whatever the case may be, because they've not transgressed a South African law. Now, coming to a diplomatic bag, it shall not be opened or detained. It obviously has to be clearly marked as a diplomatic pouch. It's got a diplomatic seal. Usually, it will be, if it's a false diplomatic pouch, carried by somebody who's a diplomatic courier with a diplomatic passport, a courier's letter, they'll be able to identify themselves. That bag does not have to go through an X-ray machine. But on the understanding that it is for official purposes only, that we don't have any drugs or weapons or anything else in that bag. It's got to be for the official use of the mission. So the RSA practice, we're not allowed to x-ray it to protect the integrity of that bag. Sniffer dogs may not intrude and actually sniff the bag at all. If there's suspect bags, they must be reported to DOGO. Now, an example I'd like to give you, we had our customs officials at our Tambo. Funny me to say that there is a suitcase that somebody is sort of claiming that it's a diplomatic bag. It didn't really have any markings on it, and I asked the official to send me a photo. I observed it. They said to me that the sniffer dog had reacted positively to this suitcase. So I said to the customs person, open up the bag. And inside, they found elephant skin, they found elephant tusks, so it was a complete violation. But we're going to be explaining how do we deal with these transgressions. It's not that they do it with impunity. Diplomatic baggage, the personal baggage of a diplomat shall be exempt from inspection in terms of Article 36. Inspection of such baggage with irregular or illegal content must be done in the presence of the diplomat. So if our diplomat is O.R. Tambo and the customs persons are now suspecting something, they're going to have to ask me, may we open up your bag? Now, we have situations where diplomats will try and bring things through illegally, articles prohibited by law. They might try and bring food items and try and claim immunities and so forth, but they may not actually bring anything which is prohibited in South Africa. Again, we're going to talk how are we going to address those issues. Now, one thing that we'd like to just highlight is that since the Vienna Convention of 61, we're talking about more than 50 years here. There's been a number of security incidents. We can talk about 9/11, we can talk about the bombings in London, which has actually necessitated a change in this exemption. So it's not actually the terms of the document, but the international practice subsequent to that. For example, if I want to go to America on a visit, we'll be asked to take off our shoes, our belts, and go through the whole scanning. It's a security requirement. Furthermore, here, it should be noted that all heads of state enjoy full diplomatic immunities and are not searched in terms of international law. This does not apply to the deputy president. But what we need to take note of here is that we apply protocol courtesy. When the president and the deputy president are traveling, they will be met by protocol officials in the relevant country. For example, the head of state comes to South Africa, they'll go through our state protocol lounges. They do not have to present themselves in person. We do it as protocol in terms of our own legislation. We'll take their passports, we'll get their luggage, and we will do it on their behalf. It's what we call the APIT. Ministers of Foreign Affairs, to a lesser extent, also enjoy immunities. Now, we talk about the portfolio of foreign affairs only. Now, all other ministers and persons are subject to search and scanning of the luggage. But even our own Minister of International Relations and Cooperation is not exempt from having her handbag and her luggage screened. But it would be inappropriate for somebody to then body search, because we're talking here about the protocol and the respect and the dignity to the person that still needs to be extended as well. Now, the diplomatic privileges. Now, moving a bit from immunities about privileges, they are contained in our policy documents. We gave the example of a single diplomatic and one card duty-free. That's just one of the privileges. Other examples are diplomatic number plates. They get a fuel levy rebate that SARS refunds them. There are certain VAT refunds that SARS does for the ambassador and for the official residence, as well as the Embassy High Commission for official purposes only. Then we also get payment of rates and taxes for foreign-owned properties that they use as a chancery or as an official residence. They obviously also have exemption from personal and public service and exemption from social security provisions. Now, all of this applies to us as diplomats abroad as well. So it's not just diplomats in South Africa. This is international practice everywhere in the world. Now, in terms of public accountability, and this is the one that I really like in terms of Article 41, all diplomats must respect the laws and regulations of the receiving state. Now, the one I also use here is that we've got the Road Traffic Act. You have to have a diplomat, you have to have a number plate. You're not allowed to park wherever you want to. You're not allowed to speed. The police will stop it. They will give them speeding fines. And we have some diplomats writing to and say, can you please squash this? And then I'll go right back and I'll close Article 41 and say, please pay. So it's not that they can do whatever they want to. There's certain processes that we follow. Now, obviously, here we've got the Diplomatic Immunities Privileges Act and the two conventions which are included. But there's also multilateral treaties between the Southern government and international organizations. We also will have bilateral agreements. So I can give an example here. Recently, the United Kingdom decided that we will not require visas for diplomatic passport holders, but we still do for official passport holders and for private citizens. So that would be a bilateral agreement with another state. The Foreign State Communities Act comes into play. For example, if there is a court order, it may not be enforced because there's a procedure that needs to be followed. If somebody issues a summons against a government, they have to work through our Department of Justice, who then actually have to serve it on the foreign government. So they can't just go to a diplomat and serve a summons on a diplomat. So there's a procedure that needs to be followed. Immigration Act. The new amended Immigration Act applies to diplomats as well. The children traveling with them must have the unabridged birth certificate. So they don't get any exemptions. We spoke about the Road Traffic Act, Value Added Tax Act. They obviously also pay for back on all of their items if they go to the supermarket to buy food and all of that. So the only thing that they're going to get back is for the official residence and for the embassy or the High Commission. Firearms Act. If they want to own a firearm, they have to go through exactly the same processes as everybody else. There's no difference. So the African Citizenship Act, that obviously applies. For example, we have some British nationals that have got dual citizenship. So they're not going to be getting full diplomatic immunities if they've also got South African citizenship. So they will only have cultural immunities and not the full diplomatic immunities. There's also the Russian Passports and Travel Documents Act, which is responsible for Russian diplomatic passports. And one very important one here that actually close to my heart was the Labor Relations Act. As we said, there are sometimes abuses, the way they treat their locally recruited staff, who are usually South Africans. And then we have the CCMA that will then assist them to open up a case. The CCMA will send us the actual complaint. We will forward it to the foreign mission, and then we'll say to them, we're giving you 10 days within which to respond. Now, in a number of cases, the missions will come back and say, you know, yes, we did fire the person on the spot. Maybe we shouldn't have, you know, given the person a severance package or whatever the case may be. But some missions will just claim diplomatic immunity, unfortunately, and we're not able to resolve the issue. Diplomatic security, something which can be quite sensitive. In terms of the Vienna Convention, we have a special duty to provide security. Now, that does not mean that we have to provide physical security. You would see on the news yesterday, it was breaking news on ENCA about the Americans with the security alert, that they're concerned about the American interests in South Africa, as well as their embassy and their consulate general throughout South Africa. So what we did, we contacted the diplomatic policing unit. This was also after we received a note from the Americans to say we are concerned. We then have increased the security around that particular thing. So for any country, it applies to anybody, irrespective of who the countries are, everybody gets treated equally. We get a concern from them, we will send it to our security cluster, they will do a threat assessment. Because sometimes the threat might only be in their country, it might not be an imported threat into South Africa. So we assess all of those things. So obviously the DPU, the Diplomatic Policing Unit, is the nodal point for diplomatic security. They conduct regular patrols, admissions, and diplomatic residences. That would be of the ambassador, not of, of all the diplomats. It's into criminal cases against diplomats. But what I should have perhaps added here, we also have criminal cases by diplomats as well that we deal with. Provide security commissions for diplomatic functions. You will know, for example, when there's a national day, we will have a South African minister who will then go make a speech on behalf of the government. And there's a lot of vehicles, there's 300-400 persons, so we get the Metro Police, who also then assist us with the traffic and the general security around those events. They assess the security requirements of diplomatic missions. They give advice to them on security, conduct security test analysis on missions for static policing. So the only time we will actually physically have static policing is when there is a genuine threat. And it's for a very short period. Our security council will say we're really concerned about the current situation, for example, with the Americans. Let us post 3 or 4 vehicles just for visibility to deal with it for a short period. When the threat is over, they withdraw. Diplomatic categories. Now, when I mentioned about an ambassador's son raping somebody and they have full diplomatic immunity, they can't be arrested. But let's use an example of somebody who's got functional immunity. So somebody who's got full diplomatic immunity is at a diplomatic mission. So all the missions in Victoria are diplomatic missions. But now here in Cape Town, we've got a number of consulates general. So the persons that are working there only have functional immunity. So let us just say there's a diplomat from one of the consulates general here. It's Friday night, into the waterfront, have a few drinks, drive home, very drunk. Causes an accident for somebody on the road. That person only has functional immunity, which only covers them in the exercise of their official duties. After hours, they don't have any immunities at all. Now, one misconception is persons think that as soon as you have a diplomatic passport, that you have immunities and privileges. Immunities only apply to those persons who are accredited to the relevant receiving state. For example, I was based in Zimbabwe. I only had immunities in Zimbabwe. The minute I got to Blackbridge back into South Africa, no immunities. I was just an ordinary South African. So I cannot misuse my position in Zimbabwe and transgress in South Africa. So we're going to address how we're going to be dealing with issues. Diplomatic challenges being faced are abuses of diplomatic immunity and privileges when they misuse their immunities. For example, claiming immunity when they refuse to pay rent. And then they go, oh, but I've got diplomatic immunity, I don't have to pay. Or they don't pay for services. Or they purchased something and they've gone to the dentist. We had a case of somebody going to the dentist and refusing to pay. But they are compelled here in terms of the Vienna Convention. Other challenges are the abuse of privileges in diplomats purchasing items duty-free and retail the items at a profit. Okay. Now we have diplomats who go to a duty-free shop, that is to say they can buy a bottle of whiskey there for 100 rand, at a bottle store it costs 200 rand, so they've already got it at half the price. And then they just put up another 50 rand on that one, and they make a profit. There's a lot of revenues for the South African government, So obviously the transgression of it, deeper. So the diplomatic challenges in terms of Section 11 of the DIPA, we pay for the rates of taxes of foreign property. Now this is a large financial responsibility for DIPA, but what we have done is a reciprocity survey with all of our missions abroad, and we've recommended changes just reducing the budget in this regard. So this is something that we are currently dealing with. Now, abuse of status by diplomats. Remedies available. Now, this is where we're actually going to be addressing some of those issues. We say Article 41, diplomats are bound to respect the laws of the receiving state. We have summoned a number of ambassadors into the office and say, Ambassador, this is unacceptable. Deal with it. We can request an official apology by the sending state. In the case of the rape with that ambassador's son, we requested that country to waive the immunity of that son. It's for that particular event. That country has agreed to that. So now we are going to charge that boy and we are going to hopefully convict him of rape. They're not going to get away with raping a South African national. We can request the sending state to recall an offending diplomat. We can also deregister them. Honourable members, you will remember recently we had the Rwanda case where we declared them persona non grata. Now, there were persons posing as diplomats. It's not a diplomatic function to assassinate somebody. So, what did we do? We summoned the ambassador. We then declared four of their diplomats persona non grata. But there was also a diplomat from Burundi as well. So they were also declared persona non grata. They were told, you're no longer welcome in South Africa. You've got so many days to get out. Family, anybody else, they not undesirable. What they then did, in diplomacy, is sit for tax. So they kicked out all of our diplomats in Rwanda, except for the ambassador. So the ambassador was left running the mission completely on their own. So obviously it was a political issue as well, where they retaliated. Disputes between states, there's also remedies available to states, but as you know, South Africa always starts to negotiate. We don't really go to the root of breaking diplomatic relations. If there's breach of international law, we may approach the International Court of Justice. We can request an official apology or correction of a wrong, and then obviously we can break diplomatic relations. Now, in the last 20 years, only diplomatic relations that we have broken was with Taiwan, when we then established diplomatic relations with China, and we now have, the Taiwanese have a liaison office here, we have a liaison office there, and we have an agreement that determines their immunities and privileges. So, honourable members, I think that in a nutshell is diplomatic immunities and privileges. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Advocate Dayaka, do you want to add anything? Oh, okay. Thank you. Another member, comments and questions?
There was a hand up. Honorable Kalyan and Rahman.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to know, members of Parliament are issued official passports. When they travel on an official passport, what immunities and privileges accrue or go with that passport? Then, the second thing is, DIRCO's responsibility to the Pan-African Parliament. I unfortunately didn't carry my purse with me, but when I became a member of the Pan-African Parliament in 2009, DIRCO issued a diplomatic card, identity card, and it has since stopped. DIRCO now refuses to issue that. I'd like to know what is the thinking on that, because it's like a smart card, you know, like your ID. Because you know, members coming into the country, often from other countries now. Maybe the AU passport, the red passport is not recognized, they have some difficulties. So at least if they have that diplomatic card, it was making things easier. So those are my two questions. And would you consider issuing it again?
Thank you, sir. It's actually Bergman in English, and not a but I'll take it out of way, which is easier to pronounce. So I'm interested in the security, especially in light of what's just been reported in News 24 in terms of the American embassy. A lot of the times when you go to an embassy, you find that the security exactly looks international. It looks like their own police or their own security. So I'm interested to see how that relationship and security is then, who has the jurisdiction. You know, if we're responsible for the security, how is that jurisdiction? Let's say someone trespasses on the property and the American police arrest that person. Do they hand that person over to the South African police? Do they have to call the South African police to that, to a premises? How that actually would work? In terms of an ambassador, the Prudential said that it's very hard for South Africa, they're very diplomatic, and they always try negotiations first. We often have about ambassador recalls, you know, that certain people or parties are pushing for an ambassador to be recalled. What is the process there? How easy is it, or how, you know, what would we say is the cause for that state? Right? There's not a crime that has been committed, or there hasn't been any offence per se, but because of a pressure from a lobby group or whatever the case may be, on what basis would you then call such an ambassador?
Thank you very much, Chef. I think this diplomatic community shows how complicated the world of diplomacy is. It's a very complex situation. But let me ask, this diplomatic immunity, does it surpass our own domestic law? Because again, the sub judice matter. When Al Bashir was let to go, one of the explanations given was that he was granted full diplomatic immunity. So I just want to find out if does it surpass our own domestic law. Secondly, Chair, I just want to find out on this issue of disputes involving locally recruited personnel. I think it's a very serious issue. I always get people, our local staff, calling me about this dispute with embassies. You have given some form of mechanisms of what you do. What labor laws are the locally recruited personnel following? The receiving or the sending state one? And how can we navigate around that? Because it's not only our locals here. It might also, when they are at the other states, that they still face the same thing. How do we sort that one out? Because it's quite a serious issue that is affected. And I'm glad that someone is paying this attention from yourself. Let me pause there. I will come back.
Honorable Sharpe.
Thank you, Chair. I think some of the questions that I wanted to ask has been asked by the two colleagues. That's why I was suggesting that maybe we have three, because we have three members of the DAA. Only one must speak, Chair. Not three of them. Because we are taking all of our questions that you want to ask.
Well, it's not DAA, but it's
not DAA. Oh, that's
not really, I want to emphasize on them. Some questions that were asked by Honorable Kalyan. I was traveling to US last week, and I was using my official passport with other South African delegations. But it does not work there, Chair. Yes. You are just treated as a criminal there. You shook off. They are very fake. They are shouting at you while you are still standing on a queue. That's it. You are a non-entity. I just want to get the opinion from the court. Yeah, it does not matter.
Actually, having an official passport to the US is a crime.
Oh, no, I'm always on red flag.
Yeah.
Very different.
It's a red flag.
Yeah, secondly, Chair, I don't know, I was reading on DA, it's EFS now speaking. Chair, secondly. I was reading in the newspaper, I think 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, that some tourists have been affected by them in South Africa, practiced by our own SAPS. I don't know if other colleagues have heard that. Especially when we arrive from the airport, and then they just identify you that you are from South Africa, and then what is the role of the DECO there? Because it comes back to South Africa as a country. Because those people, they do report those things, and it reflects bad the country. I just want to get an opinion. The other matter is that this was read by Honorable Mukarapin, the issue of labor. I really want to know what is the DECO doing, because it reflects bad. You can't allow people to be treated dirty by the people from outside. Because other members, they have unions. Does the role of the union apply, or is just one of those things? Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable
Khadre. Let me say, I wanted to lash on a question of the full diplomatic immunity of the head of state. What does that mean? Whatever. So it means that the head of state cannot be arrested anywhere in the world.
Umbrella?
Can you note it?
Yes, I. Before I speak, I just want to assist you, Chair. We can't have the same discussion we had. Bring it by the back door. I think the official case should not come in a different manner. I don't think we are going to answer. Wait, can I assist all of you? A member or a person has the right to express his or her point of view, wrong or right. That you agree or disagree is another matter, but you are entitled to their views. Over to you, Kumran. There's a right to be wrong.
Right. We have been through this before, and so I think that we need not go back by back door. Anyway, secondly, I just wanted to find out from Jericho. I really am worried about the approach if somebody has committed a crime. Like murder, that there's very little you can do about it. Just let that person go. Unless, can you please waive your diplomatic presence, Mister? Can you, knowing that that can be life in prison? Very few people will do that. Is there no way that happens? The law, or even the treaty, we can try and change it in any other manner to try and stop it, because that's very, very serious. The civil matters is much, which you agree, I mean, it's easier, but what about if we use Article 41 tax? It has no effect in that. That is my main
Thank you for the presentation. My first question will be on the issue of the diplomatic bank. As the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations Act 27 says that the bank shall not be opened. Now, South African practice is the reporting that bank must be reported to DECO. What is the next step from DECO? As my understanding that we are also bound by the Vienna Convention. Secondly, dispute between states, that is breach of international law. Request on correction of wrong in that breach of international law. And then in this case, the state may break diplomatic relations. Now my question is, this is a Christian. We're supposed to apologize for the correction to be wrong. But now, why is the state? Why is the state now sending state? How can the sending state break the diplomatic relations instead of sending another official to replace the official who has done the wrong? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What would happen if perhaps the question should be, what recourse does a private person who has rented a house or a flat to a diplomat who then refuses to pay rent and has signed a contract, and a contract is legal and enforceable, but in this instance the diplomat is actually breaking the contract, and there are two possibilities. The landlord may take the diplomat to court, or the landlord, if he knows the diplomatic immunity, may go to the department. The department can then speak to the sending state to do something about that. Any answers on that? And how do we assist South Africans in this matter? And I'm reminded of an instance, you know, in the 80s where political activists, I think it was two or three, ran into a British embassy, and the police could not arrest them. Now, if a criminal or somebody suspected of being pursued by the police runs to a diplomat and holds on his jacket or his hand or whatever, what happens to that person, to that alleged criminal? Or the diplomat harms the person. What must happen? What will the police do? On the CMA, I think people have already answered. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. You want to come back?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got two things. The first one is related to what Honorable Chair said. What recourse, if any, can the person who has lost a breadwinner, who was murdered by people and ran away, sample that land? Thirdly, how do you ensure that, because you said that the diplomat is not supposed to misuse the diplomatic bag, how do you know that he does not when you don't check? What method do you know to get to know that he has not misused if you can't check? Because I would say that you tax, but you know, maybe it's you who does that, who do that. How do you know that he has not misused?
Over to you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. The first one, I think, was the official passport for members of Parliament. Now, one thing we need to take note, an official passport is a diplomatic passport, is merely a travel document. Now, a diplomatic passport is issued to the President, the Deputy President, the Ministers, the DGs, the Premiers, judges, and then obviously Durko, officials that are traveling abroad, and all of our diplomats abroad, whether you're from DGI or whatever, if you South African diplomat or to get diplomatic passport. Now, JERCO, a state protocol, we are responsible for actually doing the notes of balls to get the visas. So it is merely a travel document. So there should not be any situation where you're treated differently just because you've got an official passport. Now, the Americans obviously have a concern about safety and security. So I don't think that we can use the case of how you treat this in America as being the standard across the board as well. So it's not only diplomatic and official passport, there's private passport, there's also what's called a laissez-passer, but the UN issues an AU as well. So there are travel documents that will then denote, in a way, on diplomatic passports, it will say that this person is an official of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, or it will say this person is our ambassador based with us in High Commission London, or is the minister of whatever portfolio. There's official passports, it's not endorsed. But there should not be any differentiation between a diplomatic or official. It's still an official document where we then facilitate officially visas for those documents which are. Now the PAP, that's a part of the international organization. We also have the UN, we have IOM, we have a whole number of international organizations. They all give ID cards. So I'm not aware of PAP persons no longer getting ID cards because we are actually the issue authority and our office specifically deals with those. So it's the first time that we're hearing that they no longer have the ID cards. What we need to explain here, we are no longer issuing ID cards for children because of children making misuse of their privileges. So we will only issue to the diplomat and their spouse/partner, not to the children. So I think that's something that we'll just have to follow up then about the IDs for PEP.
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
How would you follow up because an African is sitting on from the 4th of October when this committee did an oversight visit to the Pan-African Parliament? That was one of the questions that the Vice President asked. That report has not come before this committee yet, but I'm sure the Secretary can pick up the report stating very clearly that DELCO does not issue the identity card. So how you follow up, if you can tell me, because I sit on the rules of Pan-African Parliament, I'd like to report.
Okay.
Honourable Member, I'm the director responsible for that unit that issues the ID cards. So all I need to do is discuss it with the officials to find out if any challenges. And as I say, we're not aware of any challenges. But then we also have a multilateral branch that we can also then consult. But as I said, from our side, on the operational side, we are not aware of it. Now, when it comes to security, for example, U.S. Embassy and about jurisdiction, for example, case of the Americans, they've got the Marines. That is how they do the internal security. So if you look at the wall outside the American Embassy, the inviolability of that premise starts from the gate. So a South African police official may not enter at all unless it has been granted permission to do so. So if a criminal did run in, they would actually take them, throw them out and hand them back to the police. But I think my colleague Mr. Diago will talk about asylum issues and so forth. So when it comes to jurisdiction, the property is inviolable. Now, the only time we'll be able to enter, let's say there's a fire, then obviously our fire department would jump over the wall and put out the fire. And it would not be regarded as an infringement of the inviolability because you are not going to save their property and maybe lives as well. So we just need to make that distinction. Yes, they have a right to bring in their own security persons, which will be operating inside their property. They don't have any jurisdiction outside the front door. The disputes with locally recruited staff members. As I said, we do follow a process. We are not party to the dispute. We act basically as a post office. And we do try and resolve that. Even abroad, the Vienna Convention says respect the laws and regulations of the receiving state. So all the locally recruited staff members in South Africa, the missions must comply with the South African labour laws. So our persons, for example, abroad, our embassies and high commissions must also adhere to the local laws that apply there. But now we can also have discrepancies. In some other countries, for example, a woman won't have rights. But in South Africa, we do have rights. So we have to adhere to the laws in that country. So we can't necessarily enforce what we do here in another country because it's a sovereign state. The official passport, as I've indicated in my presentation, there are no privileges. So wherever you're traveling, if I can maybe give an example of the president traveling. Only our president, when he's traveling abroad, will have a full diplomatic immunity, the Minister of International Relations Cooperation to a lesser extent. But everybody else is traveling, whether it's the president's bodyguards, the doctors, whoever it is, None of them have any immunities at all. Now, the only thing that will happen, the person who travels abroad, he'll be met formally by somebody on that side, it's usually protocol, and will be facilitated through the safe protocol lounge. But that's only, that's what we call the AC. So that will be the core group of persons around the president or the deputy president. Everyone else has to go through normal channels. So if you've got a diplomatic passport or an official passport, you can't say, I'm not going to be searched, I'm not going to be subjected to whatever the entry requirements are. Now, in South Africa, we say everybody must meet the entry requirements, irrespective of who you are. For example, when President Obama came to South Africa in June 2013, the port health official stood outside Air Force One and said, where is the canister where the plane was sprayed? You need the proof. Where is President Obama's yellow fever certificate because he traveled to a yellow fever country? They had to meet all of those requirements, irrespective of who you are. Whether you're president of America or president of another country, everybody gets treated the same, they must all meet our entry requirements. So, so therefore, also when we travel to South Africa, we sometimes have a big South African flag up here, we're representing South Africa. So then obviously we also then comply with whatever the entry requirements are for that country. Yeah.
Yeah. Chair, with your permission.
Yeah.
As now the honourable members will understand why they were made to take off the shoes, empty all the pockets, because you treated President Obama the way he did with his president. And that's what they've done. It's to be said.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. If we come to the issues like tourists, that obviously then are attacked, coming from the airport and so forth, that is actually a staff matter. But I'm sure that the committee is also aware of Operation Fiala, which Durka also sits on. And we previously gave a presentation to the same committee about the consular relations and our obligations in terms of South African nationals abroad. And that was after the Nigeria disaster. So in a case like this, obviously those foreign missions are responsible for their nationals. But in South Africa, we also have an obligation to the guests in our country as being dealt with actually through Operation Fiala. For diplomatic immunity, I think the case of rape or murder and so forth, what we're talking here is about the process. The example I gave of an ambassador's son raping somebody. We're not saying the person's going to get away with rape, but they cannot be arrested there and then and thrown into a cell. We follow a process. As soon as there is, for example, a rape, a case will be opened at the South African Police Services. They will then send us a report. Then we commence with the process of actually dealing with that rape case. So it's just the procedure which is slightly different. That is also, for example, if somebody is renting a property, but I think Mr. Diaba will go into more detail there. Diplomatic bags, Zirko, what do we do? We work very closely with law enforcement, especially your staff, your SAR, the customs person at the airport. And we also have our security cluster at the airport as well. So they also monitor what's going on. We pretty much know who the culprits are. And as I said, we have had no hesitation calling in an ambassador. Hey, ambassador, this is what we are aware of. It is unacceptable. And let's deal with it. We have actually kicked out a number of diplomats who had transgressed. Not necessarily with a diplomatic bag, but also with a number of issues. In the one case, the one country kicked out six of the diplomats and only left the ambassador. That country then decided if there's an offending diplomat, they themselves will recall that person. If we are unsatisfied with the conduct of an ambassador, we had a case where an ambassador behaved in a manner which was unbecoming that of an ambassador. We called in that ambassador on a very senior level. And we said, ambassador, your conduct is unbecoming that of an ambassador. And as the official representative of your government, this is unacceptable. And then the ambassador was told, if you're going to continue, we're going to report you directly to your foreign minister. But as it was, their foreign minister were already aware of the issues with this ambassador and actually recorded. So frequently, their governments will decide. There might also be a recall because of a new government. Okay, let me just quickly see my notes here to keep us safe. I think Africa Diaz will discuss some of the issues. person running into an embassy, I think advocates will deal with that. Misuse of a diplomatic bag, I think we've also addressed that. I think advocate Yaga will address the rest of the issue. Okay?
Good morning, colleagues and men. Thank you for being here.
I think one of the issues that Honourable Member Bergman raised is to recall, just want to add to what Lenny said, also Africa can recall an ambassador as an act of protest. And that's actually the worst indication of diplomatic displeasure. We've done it recently in Israel, we recall the ambassador as an act of protest. The role of immunity in domestic law, remember the Vienna Convention, as Lenny indicated, was domesticated by right legislation, the default. So technically, those conventions are now the force of law in South Africa and have to be enforced. So it is applicable in South Africa. This is with regard to locally recruited personnel. The principle is that, and there's actually a fiction out there that people think the territory of an embassy is part of that country. In other words, the American embassy is American territory. That's incorrect. It's a fiction. It's only inviolable. It's not extraterritorial. But technically, when the embassy employs locally or locally recruited personnel, African law is applicable. However, in terms of contract law, you can actually choose an applicable legal system that will apply. So some missions point the LRC in terms of that country's legislation. That all depends on the particular contract. Our LRC abroad are pointed in terms of local law, the law of the country which where they are appointed. Also with regard to the disputes of LRC.
Advocate, if you think that when our LRPs abroad are recruited based on the receiving country's law, what prohibits us the same thing applying here, that the people who the LRPs here should apply the South African law?
The decision law of the sending site. I mean, actually, there's a decision now at DERCO that you will appoint Africans abroad. So technically, they will have appointed here and work there. So the same could apply, and like the military embassy, they can appoint people in the United States to work here. But it all depends on the particular policy of the sending site. But also then, with regard to dispute, if LRPs are appointed in terms of the African law, then of course they can refer any disputes to the CCMA. There's an issue about jurisdiction, which the courts have not yet adjudicated on, but they can refer the disputes to the CCMA, and the CCMA must then determine when it has jurisdiction. In this case, I also want to refer to the difference between sovereign immunity on the one hand and diplomatic immunity. Sovereign immunity based in the sending state, that's the immunity which the state itself enjoys, while diplomatic immunity is vested in the individual. Also, I want to add is that the reason why diplomats have immunities is to protect them in order to do their work. They are shielded so that nobody can interfere with the performance of their work. And also, if you are a diplomatic agent, members of your family will enjoy the same immunity. Again, the reason being to protect you as a diplomat in order to do your work properly. After the immunity of the state, that's in general, as you indicated, the head of state has the same immunity as a diplomatic agent. Full inviolability, they cannot be arrested, they cannot be sued before court, exactly the same as a diplomatic agent. And then the crime by diplomats, you refer to what recourse do you have. Because they have full immunity, they can't be arrested, same with the families. But also there's a provision in the Vienna Convention to say that a diplomatic agent who enjoys immunity can still be tried in his own in the sending state. Like in South Africa, as an example, we have amended Criminal Procedure Act, Section 110A, to say that diplomats of South Africa abroad who commit an offence can try here. So in other words, I cannot get away with their acts or their time provisions. And all aside have similar provisions. So if an American diplomat here commits an offense, because of his immunity, he cannot try in South Africa. He can try in the United States to make sure that those diplomats can't get away with immunity. With regard to disputes of rent, for instance, that applies a mediation role. So we are not party to the dispute. Our diplomatic section, which then is a retro, we try and mediate. So when a tenant, a landlord, for instance, comes to that and complains about a dispute, we will then call in the middle and say, you've not paid rent, please pay. and then give them a certain time to respond. Of course, if the dispute cannot be resolved, then the tenant or the landlord, can go to court. As I indicated, because of their sovereign immunity, that's an argument they would have to raise in court. But technically, because it's a commercial activity, of course we'll have jurisdiction in terms of the foreign tax immunity side. So then they have recourse into the court. Unfortunately, because of inviolability, no court order can be enforced against the foreign tax. But then we can politically intervene to ensure that the tenants are complied with the court order. Also, with regard to the previous occurrence of that, I think you indicated that when the entry embassy, for instance, our Assange case in the United Kingdom, of course, of the invulnerability of the premises solution, the police cannot enter. However, politically, like the United Kingdom has not taken up with Ecuador to complain, to actually then expel him from the embassy. So that is also a remedy that we have in such circumstances.
Yes.
No, that's okay. You nearly answered. What I'm saying is that two issues. Now, that person cannot be arrested in Salah. If there is a law in his own country, and he has died, but the cost to I am, I my father, and I died, and I'm going to eat. So I make the return. Secondly, can I go to his own country, that you, what the cost do I have? Thirdly, you will ask whether is there a way of changing that law or treat. That's because this is getting very bad. Is there a way you can get that? Now, thirdly, I think you didn't answer me on the question of how do you know that the diplomat is bad. Because you don't check. Now do you know that he has not been killed or has been killed? But he cannot check.
Kalapa, you want to make it for after?
That's the last one.
Yeah,
I just want to find out in terms of
the last follow-up.
Yeah, this is the last. It's plenty of runway, definitely. In fact, we need a workshop and a session. And this is an interesting thing because it's the heart and soul of our work. I just want to find out whose responsibility is it when you put credentials of a diplomat to the receiving state and get accredited, but they found that maybe the credentials of a diplomat are not up to standard. Okay, or there's no qualification or they're fake or whatever. Whose responsibility is it to recall the receiving or the sending state?
Marhaban?
Right. This is just to follow up on my colleague. My colleague Sacha at the workshop. Never mind, there used to be a training for international relations. It was almost like the training of a diplomat, that you could go for a workshop, and once you'd finished that, you'd almost done some of the training of a diplomat. We should maybe look at that. But my question was not just as a sending state, but as a receiving state. What recourse in terms of the recall? So the one part was wanted, but how? So let's say you want to expel the ambassador. On what grounds is there a way that you could expel the ambassador from your country besides an illegal act or anything of that sort?
Let's try to answer your first question. When you ask for the law or the agreement of the receiving side for an ambassador and you refuse that you don't have to give reasons, the same when you want to expel an ambassador, of course that's a very serious act of diplomatic displeasure. So you can expel an external American ambassador without giving reasons. You don't have to give a reason. But that, of course, will be retaliated for. For instance, with Morocco, South Africa doesn't have an ambassador there. We have a chargé d'affaires for certain reasons. With regard to the recall, so unfortunately, you have no recourse. because of immunity. But you can, if my father's been killed in an accident involving a diplomat, because of his immunity, you cannot sue him. So technically, you can try with a civil suit, but unless the same is waived his immunity, there's no recourse you have, unfortunately. It's a very drastic situation, but that is how the law is. Well, you have to prove, for instance, well, you can just hold him vicariously liable by arguing that he acted in an exercise of his function. But it's then a question of the detection, and of course the court will have to pronounce on that. You can why not do him in his actual sight? Again, the question of jurisdiction. Because all the in the act was committed without jurisdiction. So I think that would be very difficult to prove jurisdiction. Whether we will change the convention, because it's a multilateral treaty, which took years to conclude in 1961, it's highly likely that it will be able to be changed. Because it actually codified customs international law, which has been in effect for hundreds of years. So it's highly likely that, because as I indicated, the reason for immunity is to shield the diplomat.
If I can just answer then about the credentials. Now
I'm sorry for the interjection. Just want to welcome the members who have sent us, Honorable Dudley, and Honorable Mwango, and Honorable Paul. Now, I see that Honorable Mwango, who sent us late, and did not have a privilege to say something. Is raising his hand, and as people have indicated, this is a very interesting presentation on privileges and immunity. So I want to congratulate his right to say your say, and then Dion, you answer, and Professor Maluka. Over to you, Mwango.
thank you, Chairman. My apologies for working in late. I actually had attended another committee. Well, indeed, this is a very interesting discussion. Now that you said this was going to be the last round of follow-ups, then that's why I raised my hand, because it's still not clear in my mind this issue of immunity, either diplomatic or otherwise. Then I just want to make a hypothetical case, and then maybe the officials will be able to answer me. Suppose the United Nations Security Council suddenly decides to hold its meeting in Garaga Estate tomorrow, and the UN Secretary General is there. So what is the status of Garaga Estate at the time when the meeting is taking place? And suddenly one criminal runs into Garaga Estate while the Security Council is in progress. Will the South African police have any access to that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. About the credentials, we will send the CD, for example, of one of the ambassadors to a country. What they'll do in the sanitize if they want to send an ambassador to South Africa. So we send a CD, we send a letter ball, say we would like to send this person as our ambassador to replace the previous one. What that country will do and what we do, we send it through to the security cluster. One of the things that they will check is through Interpol. Is there a criminal record on this person? We will send it to state security. We will send it to crime intelligence. We will send it to the whole security cluster to check out, have we picked up anything on this person? Now, recently there was a request where this country wanted to appoint this person as the ambassador. And we picked up that this person was actually involved in rhino poaching, amongst other things. That's what we picked up to Interpol. So immediately it was a red flag. Now, we don't have to actually respond to that country and say no. But as advocate the other, we don't even have to give reasons. So we can approach it two ways. We can write them a note of all, referring to their request and say it's not approved, full stop. Or we can say, we're just not going to respond. And that is a message to them. They're going to start asking informally on a very low level, but how come are you not approving this ambassador's appointment? And then we'll say to them informally in engagements to say, it's not been approved, we've got some concerns. So we actually go through a whole process before we allow that person to come into the country and we grant them the full diplomatic immunity of the privilege. Remember once they're here, it's very difficult for us then to say, actually we didn't do a proper check, but now all of a sudden the person is involved in high-level voting as an adult. The diplomatic bag misuse, I think one of my previous responses indicated that we know who the culprits are. We know who's misusing the bags. Because we also have our intelligence and security clusters that are also monitoring what happens in the country. Let us just, I like to use the example of the rhino poaching. We know that a certain monkey is involved and they are involved in the whole process and making money off it. Then our security cluster said that, you know what, this is what we picked up, let's deal with it. And through a process of engagement, we will then actually address the issues without saying to them, we know full well that you put that gun or horn in a diplomatic bag and off it goes. So we do deal with it both politically and administratively. So administratively, if that doesn't work, we escalate it politically. Like we do with all disputes that we're not able to resolve administratively. I think the expelling of an ambassador, it can be both ways. It can either be them recalling, or it can be us kicking out the ambassador. I think I've given the example of one ambassador that we actually kicked out. Then I think that Diago will speak about the UN summit and about the immunities there. Thank you. Yeah.
To address your question, sir, about the UN, for instance, we will then house the UN under a host country agreement, which we conclude between the UN and South Africa. In that host country agreement, there will be a particular clause or an article addressing immunity. One of those immunities will be the inviolability of the premises. Like Gallagher said, for the time when the summit will take place, will be inviolable. So I think it won't be UN territory, it's only inviolable. So I think it's the South African government, representatives of officials, cannot enter without the approval of the UN. So if the fugitive runs in there, we cannot, of course, enter. However, because of their duty internationally, comply with South African law, we can request them to hand over the person to our country. That's the principle.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also to my Deputy Minister, and also for allowing me to use this chair. No, I wanted to say that the way I see this happening on the ground, it's always a combination of three things, which, of course, I think Dion has spoken to quite a lot. There's always the legal element, the political, and the security. So the checks and one, if one doesn't work, one track doesn't work, you always have the other track to use. And so like I was provoked by the question that you were raising yourself, okay, how do you know that the back, security people will know, they will know the, as you are saying, they will know the individual, they will, it's not something that you get from the Vienna Convention. And in the same way, if something is happening that we're unable to do because of the of existing conditions, we have the minister, we have the DG, we have the envoy, so we have a whole range of political tools that we can use to engage the state. So what I wanted to say is that it's not only the instruments are there, the conventions are in place, but the actual diplomatic work, it's a combination of a number of things. And then also the issues that you also answered, how you deal the issue that Honorable Khalafa was raising about the ambassadors and so on. All countries, they do security clearance, they correct security clearance on the proposed people that are proposed as ambassadors to their own countries. So the three are always together. And then one is dominant at one point and so on. It's never one solely on its own. You know, otherwise, the diplomatic, the world of diplomacy will not function. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think that on this one, a way must be found, maybe with the speaker, that a workshop be conducted by the department for members of parliament. It would be very interesting, it would be important rather, that members of parliament, because from time to time they travel from one country to another, they understand this. registers of legislation. I'll try to speak to the office of the speaker and see if a workshop like for the members of parliament cannot be arranged. Yeah, thank you very much. The next item is on the adoption of the minutes of the previous meeting. 15 April, all of those days there. Yeah, the department can't be released.
No, it's only the next. I want to go to the next one.
Oh, okay.
Can you see me?
Members, let us quickly
walk through the minutes of 15 April, 3 June, 17 June, 19 August, 26 August. And then the last item will be the joint oversight visit to KDOTEC. And I hope that that has, you have made a copy of the oversight.
Yes, sir.
The program. Yeah, so you must hand over to all the members. Where is Gordon? Then I go out to Gordon. Okay. Let's have minutes 15 April. These minutes, honorable members, were not adopted. Can I draw your attention to page 1? Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. And then page 5. Is there any matter arising from the minutes? I know the date. Can I invite a mover for adoption and a seconder?
I move for adoption.
Thank you very much. The minutes are so adopted. The next set of minutes is the 3rd June. There you are on page 1, and the people who attended and the legal practice. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. And page 6. I think the name of the chapter and the date should have appeared on page 6. Because we are wanting to sign on page 5. Then there is something that explains the title of the person who signed. I think for the one that I must sign, just by grace, I can make adjustments to the other side. And then see he was crashing finally left the machine. Remember, any matter arising out of this? Now, Kalyan?
Page 4.
Yes.
The Pan-African Parliament, the host agreement, etc. I think as the professor that walked out just now.
Sorry about this.
He said that everything has been sorted out, the agreement has been sorted out. Has it come before this committee? Because I missed the two sessions. So I want to know if that sorting out agreement has come before this committee. And secondly, regarding the ambassadors in Ghana, Cameroon, and Japan, we made a request to the department. The deputy minister came and said, that was I think in February, said that we must give a month to the sort out, and I don't think we've ever gone back to that issue. and then allegation against Mr. Moniela. I see that Durbo has a new spokesperson, but what is the is the situation in regards to the investigation and the allegations against Moniela?
Thank you. Are you done?
Yes,
sir. Lumawal, are you able to assist on the... Yes.
I think the department is not here. I really appeal to the office of the chairperson to change his query to the department so that they can get written reports around that. Thank you.
Around the Munela, and
No, it is not possible that we also defer, but when you notice this thing, the matter arising there, so that it was by the department. Can I hear you? Oh, thank you very much. The minutes are so adopted. And let's go to the minutes of the 17th of June. Page 1 and page 2. Page 3. Yeah. Can I hear you? Any matters or matter arising? Honorable Raputi. No matter arising? Okay. Honorable Raputi moves for adoption. Any seconder? Kalapa second. The minutes of the 19th August. Page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4. Mm-hmm.
Now, on page 3, start, paragraph number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, where, 7, where it says whether there was any latest information on the Nigerian girls who were captured by the Boko Haram terrorist group. Is it captured or adapted? Okay, captured, maybe I did not have a paragraph with that. But the Sikh nation of Boko Haram, is it an insurgency or terrorist groups? I know the dividing line is always where it stands on it. Terrorist group. Oh. Okay. Can I hear you?
Do you have that presentation?
Yes.
Has it been distributed to the number?
It was there, but it
was because of the
equipment.
So, what was going on, Jan?
I'll reprint, or I'll ask for just a few minutes.
Yes, sir. In what form do you want it, Mukala?
It is a presentation form.
Yes. Yeah. The presentation that was made by Kounde, are you assisting?
Uh-huh. I think it would be easier if the Babalo or member maybe flash disk would be enough so that we can hear, to give you the link so that we can download it for you.
Yeah.
Order, member.
This computer has got stuff. Why are you working
in time? There is a number that the signature on another report. You can't make noise.
So what do you need?
Another one?
Sir?
We want to raise that number, your way. Okay. Can I hear you on the minute? Hello, Dudley? Okay. Thank you very much then. The minute I saw adopted. The next set of minutes is dated 26 August this year, of course. Page 1. Page 2. Okay, then page 2. Lapa Bulo Kunja. Lovano. Who's that here? The one of the department. Who's that here? Were you referring to Zahir?
No.
Oh, the spelling is Zahir. Yeah. Oh, okay. Page 3.
page 4. Page 5. And,
there's a new chair on page 5.
Yeah, because the chair was absent. Can I hear you? On the minute of last week?
Between
letters and
arriving?
Yes.
Page 4,
the draft report. What is it?
What
about that?
We need an update on the status of the report. The committee made a request that it be presented with the draft report.
Is it reporting? Am I MBGs? But did we make a written request ourselves that was signed by the acting chairperson to the department? Because that's what must happen. But it was decided on this date, that they give us the report on the MPG. Okay, can I hear you on the adoption? Yeah. Any second? Thank you very much. All the minutes are so adopted. So the last item is on the honorable members. So the joint oversight visit to KZN by the Peace and Stability Cluster. Members would remember that in the wake of the outbreak of the... I'm not sure if we're compatible with using that concept. Yeah, I think they say attack on foreign nationals rather than xenophobia. All I was saying, that in the wake of that phenomenon, discussions ensued both at the level of government, and there was also a debate that was requested by the President in Parliament. There were explanations that were made to SADC, and there was also a presentation to ourselves here by DERCO. All the clusters within the security then agreed later that there will be a need to visit different ports of entry, such as the harbors, such as the borders, and such as the airports. And mainly, you have the base bridge around Limpopo, between Limpopo, South Africa, and then Zimbabwe in Limpopo. You have Libombo, which is between South Africa and Mozambique, which is in Mpumalanga. And then you have KZN. So the cluster then decided that there must be a visit. Then I request you, Lubabalo, to speak to this program. Well, this is not necessary. You see the program. Yeah, the program is that is from the 14th to the 18th of September, which is Monday. What we will request you to do is to indicate your availability, Nogudi, from which airport will you be boarding? From Cape Town, from Johannesburg, from PE,
to Kinshasa, then so that they can do the booking for you. They can do the booking for you, and you will then be able to join the crew there that will visit those areas as indicated from Tuesday at that particular time. And who is going to do the bookings for the members here? Can they make sure that they have the cell phone number and the landline number of that specific person? Can you assist us there?
Thank you, Chair.
Chair, what's the thank you, sir. Chair, during the oversight, members will be divided in two groups. The first group will be defense and military veterans, IR, and then 50% home affairs. And then the second group will be intelligence, police, and 50% of home affairs. And then in our committee, these are the four members which will be traveling under international relations. Honorable Chair, Honorable Masangu, Honorable Khadebe, Honorable Kenya, Honorable Mpumwana, Honorable Mokhalaba, Honorable Bergman and Honorable Quarter. And under Home Affairs, it is Honorable Mashile. Yes, okay. Two. Yes. Honorable Mashile, Honorable Rafuti, Honorable Nesi, Honorable Kumede, Honorable Maitrin, Honorable Ngomo, and Honorable Figlas. So two of the members who are serving in the committee will be traveling under Home Affairs. And the reason is Honorable Mason and the Honorable Raputi. The reason being was to share costs among the committees, not to put burden on one hand. It's a matter of resources, it's not in any other reason. Yes. No, it doesn't change anything. It's just resources, we're trying to split costs. So that the committee has to. It doesn't change nothing.
Hello, Kumlan. I hear my name being mentioned.
Is that right? Yes, it's you.
Because there is a traffic force in the process of
that's my name, I know that. Proceed to Kumlan. Babu Kumban, are you done?
Yeah, see, as I said, I understand a little bit.
Okay. You want to play still for the whole week? For a specific day?
Actually, I'll be playing international rugby on an international rugby
club. No, you're not playing rugby.
Rahman? Honestly, that's not. You are not available? You know, I said the thought. Like I was saying, to mail out all the members, MLS, and I'm talking about video on hold, I'm SMS, and ask them to respond with what available now, and but also know what you, so that a booking can be made for them to Kinshasa. And I think we only travel this Wednesday or Monday. But if there are members who may want to join on a Wednesday, you must also take that into account and then record everything so that you know who is where. And you've got to inform somebody, I'm sure that Pabu would last, about those who are unable and the reasons provided. And those who are available, is something else. Anything on this matter? Yes. I think it's my mistake. I've got an SMS from my line. There's a meeting that he is attending. We are new when Baba Upadi Apollo Siga Kamaila. There's a meeting that he is attending.